I'm speaking today with Ornaldo Ibarra, who is running for state representative in District 144. Ornaldo, first question I'd like to ask, why are you running for this office?
The reason I'm running for District 144, obviously, you know, the lines have changed a little bit, and I believe that I'm the right candidate for District 144. The issues that are going to be tackled down there in Austin this year by legislators is, I think, very similar to issues that I know about. As my background is, I am a veteran, sort of having served in the Marine Corps, so I know about veterans' issues. I am a police officer in Pearland, so I know about law enforcement issues. As a police officer in Pearland, I am assigned to Pearland High School at the 9th Grade Center. So I work with administrators and teachers on a daily basis, and I also work with kids that are at risk and they get in trouble. And so I know the impact of smaller classrooms and how that can affect somebody's education. I represent a predominantly low-income area, predominantly Hispanic area. I know the issues that they're going through and the suffering. Pasadena's got one of the highest unemployment rates in the greater Houston area. I think it's at 11%. So all the issues that I believe that legislators are going to tackle in Austin this year, I think that I have a little bit of a background and experience in that, and I think that I could, as you notice, I came from work here today. So I think we need somebody that, you know, works for a local municipality. There is not a police officer that I'm aware of that's a legislator up in Austin. Most of them are lawyers or insurance people or consultants. So I think to have somebody that still is very similar to the people that has to go out there and work and work a little bit overtime to be able to provide for their family, I think that I'll be able to relate very well with and bring those concerns up here to Austin.
You are currently a city council member in Pasadena. Talk to me a little bit about what you have done on council and what experience you have had, you know, dealing with the legislature as a member of a council, since obviously cities lobby the legislature and are affected by the legislature in a bunch of different ways.
Well, Pasadena is a very different city. As you know, it doesn't get a lot of that attention for being the second largest city in Harris County. When I took office, I said the two biggest things that I want to do as a council member is, one, I want to represent the needs of my constituents. And number two is that I always want to take care of the concerns. I always want to take care of city employees, because I believe those are the people that do all the work, and we kind of take the credit for it. What I'm most proud of as a council member is, one, I have been able to excite my base as far as my voters to get engaged here in city politics, to email me, to call me. I'm the only council member up there that where my constituents have my cell phone number, so they call me. But some of the accomplishments as far as here is we provided low-income housing as far as for my district for many residents. We've done countless miles of sidewalks, countless miles of infrastructure repairs. We've added speed bumps into neighborhoods where there's a speeding problem. Anytime there's any crime-related issues, I've addressed them. So anything that I've done, anything that I can do to improve the quality of life for my constituents, I've done it, and I've been a big, big advocate for them. The biggest thing about me also is that when a constituent calls me or emails me, I return their calls. I cannot think of one constituent of mine that can say that they never received a call back or an email back or at least got their concerns addressed. So. You name it, anything that we can tackle at the city level, I've done an outstanding job representing my constituents, and I think that showed in the fact that I was unopposed in the last city election. Also, I've always been a big advocate for city employees, and I will continue to be a big advocate for state employees if elected. We're the only city this year that I know of that's passed a cost of living raise for city employees. Our city employees got a 2%. If our sales tax and property tax and our revenue looks up this year, we're obviously going to pass hopefully another 2 or 3% next fiscal year. Also, when I first got elected to council, I was a big proponent of increasing their vacation time, and also got them a cost of living 2 years ago when I first got elected. So for city employees, for state employees, I know that the pension systems are coming under attack. I'm currently under a pension system myself. So I'll be a big advocate for our state employees up in Austin.
Okay. speaking as a Houston resident, I, of course, when I think of Pasadena, I think of, you know, refineries, chemical plants, manufacturing plants, and, you know, there's issues about, you know, pollution, air quality. The state and the federal government are currently arguing back and forth about how these things should be regulated. That's a local issue here in Pasadena. Do you think the state does a reasonable job, you know, regulating emissions and pollution and whatnot? Do you think the federal government is appropriately stepping in where it believes the state has failed? What's your view on that?
I'm one that believe that the people that know the issues more are the local municipalities. They're the ones that know what the issues are. And there should be a coordinated effort between local, state, and the federal government on how to control this. Now, before the federal government gets involved, I think that the local, for example, the city of Pasadena, the city of Houston, should be communicating with state officials first, seeing they can get some type of agreement or some type of pollution control mechanism in place before the federal government gets involved. Now, it is a place for the federal government to get involved where the state and the local area can come to an agreement or can actually solve that issue. But everything should be handled at the local level. That's what I believe first before the federal government gets involved.
Okay. On a different issue that is tangentially federal, the legislature in 2011 attempted but did not pass legislation for regulating so-called sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. Which essentially would have required cities to allow law enforcement officers to, you know, detain or question people about their immigration status. Speaking both as a, you know, member of a city government and as, you know, a police officer, had that legislation passed, what effect would it have had on Pasadena?
Well, obviously, Pasadena is 70%. I think it's 65% Hispanic, and there's probably a lot of undocumented immigrants in Pasadena. And right now, one of the biggest issues that I get as a council member is I get a lot of calls from Hispanic residents indicating there's a breakdown between communication between the police and the residents, undocumented community. And I think that if sanctuary cities had gone into place, it would have definitely prevented people from calling. I had a situation a while back where a constituent of mine called me to tell me that an officer went out there and instead of asking what the crime that occurred, it was a burglary, instead that officer was trying to inquire about her immigration status. So I think what it would do is it would prevent undocumented people to report crimes. As a police officers don't have time to be questioning people as far as if they're undocumented or not. They got calls, they got reports they got to go to, they got other priority calls they've got to respond to. I think that's a federal issue. I think there needs to be a place, something in place for the federal government pass some type of comprehensive immigration reform. But I think something that gets left out of that is that, you know, I come from parents that were illegal immigrants at one time, and unfortunately it's those two, you know, that 1 or 2% that's doing bad out there. That's either drunk and killing people or, you know, committing robberies and burglaries and stuff like that to get the most attention. But what doesn't get said is the good people, the good undocumented people that come here for the American dream, that their story's not told for the most part. You know, and there's a Marine that got killed in Iraq. His name is Rafael Pereira, I believe it is. He got the Navy Cross. He came here as an undocumented immigrant, and there's many like them. And the Vietnam War and the first Gulf War, and now that go out there, serve the country bravely. There's my parents came here. They stressed the importance of education for me, for my sisters, and also they stressed the importance of serving your country. And my parents came here as illegal immigrants. Later on, became residents, permanent residents, and later on became American citizens. They invested wisely. You know, invested in real estate. And so those stories don't get told. But obviously, at the federal issue, something also that gets left out is that, you know, the people coming here is labor. people that want to come out here, the engineers and the architects that we have, I believe is a H-1 visa or HB-1 visa, they give those out. But if you're an undocumented immigrant that wants to come from Mexico or Central America to come here to come legally to either be a construction worker or a worker cutting grass, well, there's not really a visa you can apply for. You'll never get one. So there needs to be a mechanism in place where those people that want to come legally, they can go down there and apply for a visa and able to get one. But currently, I don't think there's a system in place for them to get a visa. You either got to be educated or be a skilled job that's in demand or an employer kind of asks for you to come down here.
Okay. Let's talk education, since obviously that was an issue that dominated the 2011 session. There are numerous lawsuits being under litigation to get the state to change its method of funding public education. State cut $5.4 billion from public education in the last session. What hope do you see? What would you work for to, do something about that, to get more funding in public education? What would you do?
Well, the most important thing that we get, and I think people understand, is I think we got $7.8 or $8 billion in the rainy day fund. It's a similar situation that we had here in Pasadena. And what I was, fighting for my constituents, and the same thing that I would do in Austin, is here's $8 billion. It's not the legislators' money. It's the people's money. And the people are demanding, as you've seen, there's been rallies up in Austin from educators and parents. They want to see that money spent. Nobody's saying go out there and blow the $8 billion. But if we can spend money to fund education, we need to look at the rainy day fund. It's the people's money. And the parents and educators are demanding that we use the money so we can have smaller classrooms. As a police officer and working with at-risk youth, I've seen where I have, students come to me, and when I'm talking to them, if they're getting some type of, something that I have to deal with them in the law enforcement side, and they get sent to the alternative center, and they always come back and tell me, officer, I like going to the alternative center. I do good. And I say, well, what do you mean by that? I kind of know what they're saying, but they say, what do you mean by that? Is the smaller classrooms, there's, 8 or 9 people in that classroom. If I have a question, I'm able to ask my teacher. My teacher's able to answer that question for me. I'm able to do my work. So here are students here that when they're in big classroom, where there's 25 to 30 students, they don't excel. But when they go to smaller classrooms, they tend to do better. And they end up making A's and B's or C's, but they make an effort because somebody cares. And so I think it's important that we realize, how do we get smaller classrooms? And I think we need to properly fund it. We have to look at, are there loopholes on the business tax? I don't have, I haven't looked through the budget. I know what a budget I can look at city level. I haven't seen it at the state level. But obviously there's different funding sources from different tax on businesses, from franchise fees and other things that are done at the state level. That obviously they probably need to be updated, and there's some loopholes that we need to close. But until I see a budget and I'm able to see all the revenue the state gets and from what sources, then I can make a better informed decision on that.
All right, let's talk about the situation involving the Women's Health Program. You're familiar with the dispute between the state and the federal government. Again, another situation like that. What's your assessment of that situation?
I think the thing about, Planned Parenthood, I think for every dollar the state puts, I believe the federal government puts 8 or something like that. I think the problem that we forget is that Planned Parenthood, and even myself a while back, only gets known as an abortion center, or people only perceive that it's an abortion center, but they don't realize what Planned Parenthood does that's very good for women. I think they do cervical cancer screening. They do contraception, preventive contraception. They do mammograms and some other good things for women's health that we often forget. So 80 or 90% can be preventative health care for women, and that 5% can be abortions. And yet we don't talk about the good 95% things they do. And so therefore now these facilities are losing, funding. And so we got to, I think we need to do a better job of all the good stuff they do. And, you know, for us to turn away federal money is just ridiculous. We need to put ideology aside and look what's best for our taxpayers.
What sort of legislation do you think you might pursue, or other priorities you think you might pursue that's specific to District 144?
Well, one, I think obviously education is the biggest thing for 144. Predominantly 73% Hispanic, I think. Pretty much low to middle class, if you can say there's a middle class in America. I think education. But when I talk about education, I think you need to break it down into three components. One is higher education, whether it's pursuing lower tuition for community college universities. Number two, military service. And number three is trying to get these people also to go get some type of craft. What I mean by that, there's nothing wrong for us trying to fund people that want to be welders, plumbers, or work on air conditioners. There's a big demand for skilled labor right now. And what's happening is along the refineries, some of these refineries are going out of state and hiring people to come work at these refineries. So we need to find out and identify those students at school that have, I think we think that everybody's going to go to college, but we need to be realistic. There are students in there, and students that I come across with, that have no desire in going to college. They want to be welders. They want to be plumbers. You know, they want to be pipe fitters. Let's do something to make sure these people get those certifications that they can be, productive taxpayers. This thing about everybody going to college, I just don't think in a perfect world that'd be great. But there's also demand for skilled labor. So we need those three things. Obviously, healthcare is a big thing, but we often talk about, insurance, and that's important, but also preventative healthcare. I was watching a study, something on CNN the other day about, I think it was Cameron, New Jersey, where they did this preventative healthcare type system, where they were sending doctors and nurses to these homes that I think they identified 100 people that were abusing the ERs and stuff like that. And they were costing, millions and millions of dollars to the taxpayers of New Jersey. Well, they started this system where they started educating, these patients about when they needed to go to the emergency room, or what they needed to do to stay healthy and stuff like that. And I think over a two-year course, I think the taxpayers of New Jersey cut that bill in half. So obviously preventative healthcare is important, what to eat, what not to eat, what signs to look for, when to go to the emergency room. Before I joined the military, after I got out of the military and went to junior college, I worked at the emergency room here at Bayshore in Pasadena for 3 years. And you could see in there the abuse as far as, I won't say it was abuse, but just people weren't educated enough to know when to go to the emergency room. And people were going to the emergency room waiting for 13, 14 hours for healthcare, some type of medical attention. Well, a lot of that stuff could have been prevented. And there was a lot of stuff that didn't need to go to the emergency room that could have waited a Monday morning. But I think as a society, we need to educate these people, especially, and I'm just going to take my example, 144, is when to go to the emergency room, when to go to your family doctor, and how to take care of yourself, so that way we can lower the cost of health insurance, stuff like that.
Okay. District 144 changed considerably from the previous map to the current interim map. Mm-hmm. There is still litigation ongoing, and it is likely there will be further changes. Mm-hmm. First of all, are you satisfied with the with the district as drawn by the court for the 2012 election, and what, if any, changes do you think should be made to this district as the litigation is resolved?
Well, the map could have been better, but one thing that I like about the map is that it takes in a huge amount of Pasadena. As far as could it be better, if this turned the House 309 stays, I'm going to represent these constituents to the best of my ability. If it gets changed later on in 2014, if they do any changes, or the D.C. court comes back with any changes, then we'll look at that. But currently, House 309, I'm going to go out there, work hard, and try to represent them and their concerns to the best of my ability.
You have two opponents in the primary for the nomination for 144. When people go to vote in May to pick the nominee, the Democratic nominee for House District 144, why should they vote for you and not one of your opponents?
It's very simple. I mean, if you want an individual, you know, I know I went to public schools. I went to a junior college. You know, I went to the University of Houston. I'm a military. I served in the United States Marine Corps. Got an honorable discharge. I am a police officer. When I am a council member of the city of Pasadena. If you look at what I've done and what I've done to represent the constituents of Pasadena and District A, compared to my opponents, I've been out there as a public servant. Now, I, at the smaller level, at the local municipality level, I pretty much am very familiar with some of the issues that are going to be handled in Austin. I know what it is to govern. I understand the different how to look at a budget and the different revenues and expenditures. The only thing, there's going to be a learning curve, obviously, when you go to Austin, because there's obviously different revenue sources and also expenditures. But my track record as being somebody that can be contacted, somebody that can get things done in Pasadena, I think is important. And one thing that's being left out is that Pasadena needs representation up there in Austin. Currently, if things stand and I don't get elected, Pasadena won't have any representation in Austin. And this map, House 309, if I'm correct, the city makes up about 50%, 55% of the district. And I think it's important that the residents of Pasadena have some representation in Austin and a voice in Austin.
Okay. Arnaldo Ribarra, thank you very much for talking to me today.